there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. The last couple episodes I was missing, but I listened to what you guys recorded and caught up to where we made it. And last episode finished in 1539, and we're going to just move on to the next year. We're going to start in 1540 today. If you've noticed, the last two episodes have moved in larger chunks of time than when we were in the 1520s and the early 1530s. And I think that's because, not that there's less work being done, but I don't know, would you guys say it's things are sort of being the big major points have been figured out, and now it's sort of what we've called from Luther occasional theology, where he's writing to particular pieces of issues or historical significance rather than giant sweeping doctrinal positions. Okay, so I think that's kind of where we're at. So we're going to pick up there in just a minute. Just wanted to remind everybody that the Think Fellows is part of the 1517 Podcast Network. Go to 1517.org/podcast to see all of our shows there. We actually have some new shows coming out this spring. So you should go keep checking back there. Early May, though, we're going to have two new shows up on the website. One that is another local radio show that's going to be in the Ohio area called 4U Radio. And the other one is going to be called the Christian History Almanac, and it's going to be five minutes of sort of this day in history and in various Christian historical points done by Dan Van Voorhis. So we are looking forward to those shows coming out. And as always, if you want to check out the rest of our resources like the Speakers Bureau or videos or the Academy Lectures, it's 1517.org. All right, guys, so 1540, I think one of the first works that pops up in my mind here is The Power and Primacy of the Pope from Melanchthon, which you guys touched on a little bit in the last episode while I was gone. But what's the significance of writing about what the limit of the Pope's power is this late, since they've already been challenged by papal authority and excommunicated some at this point almost 20 years ago, right? Luther was excommunicated. Mm-hmm. It seems sort of late for something going right out the Pope again comes up. Is there a particular reason why Melanchthon writes this? Is there a commission that I'm unaware of? Or
Well, it's not the only thing that he deals with in The Power and Primacy of the Pope. It is certainly the primary thing, but because of all the ideas at ordination or all the theological topics that can sort of tangentially touch ordination, there are other things that are dealt with in there. I always felt like it's an interesting document. What was supposed to happen, of course, at this meeting is that Luther was going to present small called articles, which would essentially serve two purposes. One, to be his last theological will and testament, because, of course, everybody thought, you know, he was going to die pretty soon. And second, to deal with topics not dealt with in the Augsburg Confession. So to sort of be maybe like articles 29 through 40 of the Augsburg Confession that weren't dealt with. And Luther, in a lot of ways, he does that in the small call articles. But there are by this time in their history, Luther and Melanchthon are not necessarily, publicly they very much see eye to eye, but in their personal conversations are not seeing eye to eye about tone, what kind of tone should be taken when addressing the papists, what kind of tone should be taken when you're going after sort of some of the humanists within the papist camp. And so Melanchthon really does not like aspects of the tone of the small called articles, as well as...
Because they're so assertive?
Yeah, because it's so assertive. I mean, this is Melanchthon's big issue as Luther deals with Erasmus, is not necessarily what he says in his critique of Erasmus' theology, but the tone that he takes with Erasmus.
So this is an ongoing tension in their relationship since, what, 1528 then?
Yeah. So Melanchthon writes The Power and Primacy of the Pope, trying to give some ground. Now, Melanchthon's, of course, he's known for this, right? He's known kind of for giving some ground. But with the ground that he's trying to give in The Power and Primacy of the Pope is, at the same time, making a case for why the now, I guess we could say, Lutherans have the right to ordain and call their own pastors. Because that's the charge against them that is being dealt with here, is that you can't...
The succession
issue? You can't call pastors. You're now outside of...
The church.
The church.
Yeah.
And so he starts it out, and it actually, for Melanchthon especially, it's kind of snarky as it starts out. I mean, he goes right to the throat of the issue, calling out both the Pope and the bishops for not doing their job. Essentially, that's the basis of his initial argument, is that you're not doing your job, and because you're not doing your job, we had to do something. Mm-hmm. This something that we're doing now is ordaining and calling our own pastors.
In American history, Wesley ran into that with the Church of England.
Yeah.
And started ordaining his own guys. Well, if you're in the Church of England, that's a pretty radical thing to do.
Yeah. And that's the same thing here, right? What they're doing is very radical, because they're still calling their own pastors, even though they're technically and quote-unquote outside of the church. And so that's the entirety of what's dealt with in the power and primacy of the Pope. But again, because ordination touches on like the proclamation of the gospel and the administration of the sacraments, that type of thing, you do get some tangential other issues dealt with therein.
Yeah, and this is sort of one of those issues too that I forget the exact letter it is, but Luther writes responding to people who say, well, maybe we just don't need, one of the radical responses being, maybe we just don't need pastors anymore.
Yes.
And Luther addresses that as well in personal letters to different congregations and people, basically tying things back, like Augsburg Confession Article 5 does, back to the necessity of the means of grace being distributed in the community. So this article by Melanchthon too, there's a lot of early church and like church father citations in here, like a lot compared
in there.
To.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely arguing in a sense against the papacy, but he's arguing against the papacy on the basis of error, and not on the basis of so much. I mean, he does do it, but so much on the basis of the idea that there could be a bishop that was over other bishops, right? So he would give on that point. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of where he differs with Luther. As he signs the small called articles, that's essentially what he says. Like, I'll sign these, but I would give essentially that if they were to do their job and if they were to act rightly, that this position could still exist. I mean, that's sort of the caveat that he gives when he signs is what he says. Philip Melanchthon also regard that he approves the above articles as right and Christian, but regarding the Pope, I hold that if he would allow the gospel his superiority over other bishops, which he has otherwise, is conceded to him by human right, also by us, for the sake of peace and general unity of those Christians who are also under him and may be under him hereafter. And so that's sort of the sticking point right now. We said this in the last episode, I think, is that by this point, Luther's just, he's done. He's no more patience for this, right? And Melanchthon is trying to guard against that in a little bit of a way. And so he gives that signature with the caveat, and then he actually writes what he's very, adept at doing, which is a clarification of the issue. So this is actually compiled and written earlier, though. I mean, this is written late 30s.
So this is just the publication is finally now.
Yeah.
Is this, at least for Melanchthon, just for the sake of good order, or does he believe that there's some sort of biblical requirement for hierarchy?
I think it's for good order. I mean, if I were to, that would be sort of an educated guess. And just from reading some correspondence here, he very much thinks that there has to be a system in place for doing this. He's instrumental in developing the system that they're using outside of this. And so his main contention with the Pope isn't that he's a bishop over other bishops. The contention is the error, right? And he starts that right off the bat, that the Pope believes he's got the right over the temporal sword as well, right? He's going after that, that one has to believe in the power of the bishop, and that belief is necessary for salvation. He's going after that, and he calls these articles that are tyrannical and pernicious to the church. So he's going after the error, whereas by this point, I think it's fair to say Luther's going after the position.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's done with this. Yeah.
I think it is interesting how many, like, this seems very historical in a sense, because he cites here, like, observance of what Latin and Greek churches did, and then goes on to cite fathers and stuff like that. And it seems like he's saying, hey, there's a disconnect between what the history of the church's polity or how we've organized was and has been and what it is now.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting, too, that there's an acknowledgement even in Melanchthon's signature to Smalcald and here that it's okay for there to be some hierarchy and authority in what we would call civil matters, right? He says earthly matters, right? So there's an acknowledgement that the way the church is structured as far as how the logistics work, that's left-hand kingdom stuff.
Right, okay.
We often want to put that into right-hand kingdom because it's about the church, right?
Yes, like good point.
A vote, we vote on something on a voters meeting and we call that right-hand kingdom. Melanchthon's saying here, no, if there's any of that, that's okay. It's only okay in earthly matters, which is left-hand kingdom, even though you're doing it in the church.
Wish that were more deeply in our church.
Yeah, and that's basically what he's saying throughout this whole thing. I mean, he argues against, he even says Christ, you know, forbids supremacy among apostles and the whole nine yards, but he's talking, that's specifically right-hand kingdom stuff.
Yep. Right?
You can't say my teaching is better because it, you know, is a pure gospel because it's me, and yours isn't a pure gospel because it's you. That's the type of thing that's forbidden, but not the forbidden. It's not forbidden to say, well, for the sake of order, this is the dude that manages like who goes where.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah. So it's an interesting. It's short. I mean, very easy to read if people are interested.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because things that. Like we've sort of thought we might have moved past get brought up again. So like he has a short article against indulgences again. And
right. I mean, that's the recurring theme in Melanchthon that about binding the warning against binding consciences unnecessarily. So and that's his biggest worry when it comes to this kind of thing is that adding all these extra things to justification binds the conscience.
Yeah, and that's major. I'm always looking for that in other creeds and confessions, and I don't see much of it.
Yeah.
The concern for falsely binding believers' consciences. And our guys were thinking that, and they were thinking it all the time.
Yep.
And it didn't matter if you were Roman, it didn't matter if you were Anabaptist. Nobody gets to do this to you.
There's one spot outside of Lutheranism that I read recently that I saw that concern, but I don't know if the conclusion what was sort of radical was Zwingli when it came to like practice of Lent. If you read his thing on there, the reason he was concerned with it was that you were going to unnecessarily
bind consciences
via traditions.
Well, and I do think there are some things in here that if we just look at our own church would shock the heck out of people within our own church if they were to read this carefully. I mean, he's got this line in here that if a pastor in his own church ordains someone else to be a pastor in that church, that is certainly by divine law valid. And I think that in our own sort of ecclesiology in the LCMS, you know, that's not how we operate. Although I think we would have to admit that under whatever sort of extreme circumstances, if that were to happen,
it
would certainly be valid.
Yeah, we'd have to.
But it's just not within our normal practice.
Mm-mm. And they were in a, I mean, not to, I don't want to sound like excusing it. They were in a more of an emergency situation. There was no body training up pastors for them.
Well, there was. It was called the University of Wittenberg. And that's sort of the, and then the other universities too. I mean, this is sort of the system that they ended up having. But it's more that one of the comparisons I give is it's kind of wild, wild west in the sense here is that we have to give them a little bit more latitude than we can take ourselves 500 years later because they're now forced to figure stuff out, right? Because there was, I mean, for 1,000 years, they did it one way, Right. And now that way's that way's not there anymore. What do we do? And essentially, that's what he's saying here. He's saying, listen, we were abandoned by you. We had to do something. That something has worked itself out in a variety of ways, but what were we to do? We had to do something. I like it. It's only interesting, though, if you're sort of interested in the history of what was going on at the time. Otherwise, it's kind of...
arcane?
Yeah, and it deals specifically with very in-church stuff, like ordination and
right.
call and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But the history of it's kind of fun.
Well, and that, I mean, that just, like you said, ties back to the way the forgiveness of sins is distributed. And so that it is important. I mean... You don't want people to be totally indifferent about how a pastor is called, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's what he says, sure. that it's necessary for the church to retain the authority to call, elect, and ordain
yeah.
ministers.
Yep.
And that's why we did that. Yep.
Well, interesting. So some other highlights from 1540. We have a Lutheran martyr in England. Robert Barnes is martyred in 1540. Anything significant about Barnes, Adam?
Well, I mean, just what you said, just that he's so you've got the Protestant Reformation in England in what, it's about 7 years old at this point.
And not super long.
And which direction it would go is sort of undetermined. And in the midst of these Protestants, you have some like Robert Barnes and Patrick Hamilton up in Scotland who are Lutheran in their theology from start to finish. And, Barnes himself, he was a man of pretty significant influence. Had he not been executed, who knows what would have happened. There's a connection here with the White Horse Inn, the original White Horse Inn in Cambridge, where these theologians would meet for beer, and I don't know if they ate bangers and mash back then, but whatever they ate at the pub, discussing the latest.
And to read the forbidden works of Luther.
Yeah, meeting almost in secret. Well, in secret, yeah. I think is yeah. accurate, to talk about the merits of Luther, especially Luther's theological assertions. And they're basically watching what's going on in the continent and kind of taking their cues from the continent. So I think that's probably as much. Barnes, yeah. since we were talking about the papacy, though, just a bit ago, wrote basically a history of the papacy.
Mm.
Dr. Corey Moss at Hillsdale College wrote his dissertation on at least one chapter, deals with that in particular. And it's interesting, Barnes is a no mean theologian, but also an outstanding historian who had as his method the basic assumption that if you're going to describe something in the past, what you say about the past should actually correspond to what happened in the past, regardless of what it is you're trying to prove. I don't think it's a stretch to say Corey has argued that that's where we find, I think we mentioned this last episode, the roots of the historian, the contemporary standards of historiography, because they had to make sure they had things right. They were interested, the Lutheran reformers, the Protestant reformers generally, though they're certainly, there's a spectrum here, they were interested in truth and wanted to make sure that what they were saying actually was true and not just polemic or rhetoric or what.
Can I ask you a question? Did did the humanism of Northern Europe, like in Germany, and that would differed from say the Renaissance, was that more what that looked like in England as well? So
the Italian Renaissance is, that's all that, the Renaissance is born in Italy. But the Italian Renaissance kind of stays peculiar to the rest of Northern Europe and also in the British Isles.
All right, cool.
Can I say I hate going back to it, but can I say one more thing about the power and primacy of the Pope?
Yeah.
If our listeners do read it, I'd encourage them to go to the subscriptions at the end and just look at the list of, if they're aware of the theologians of the time who signed this thing. I mean, it's some pretty big names and what will become bigger names. Guggenhagen, Nicholas von Amsdorf,
Eustace Jonas
of Magdeburg, Eustace Jonas, Martin Bucer signs it. The one that I kind of want to point out is that at the very end you get John Brenz that signs it, with a very long sort of little caveat himself.
Yeah.
It's an entire paragraph where he's acknowledging in his subscription to the power and primacy of the Pope, he's actually making an acknowledgement and a subscription to several other documents of the time too, some of which we are, you know, pretty aware of, and some that we're not. Mm-hmm. The small call articles, he says, I think that's an agreement with Scripture. But then he names things called a formula of Concord. He's not referring at this point, of course, to the formula of Concord, which will come 40 years later. He's talking mm-hmm. about another document that was written concerning the sacrament by Bucer.
Are these still extant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they can be found. I'm not sure how much of them are in English. But there's it's an interesting, for me, context, because I just helped Kelsey Klimbera, who's a student of mine, and she's been on the podcast, translate a letter that Melanchthon wrote to Brenz, where Melanchthon is sort of bringing him into the fold via this letter. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting... I mean, there's just the list of names who signed this thing is extensive.
Well, there's more theologians on here than the early confessions too, which is sort of an interesting point.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting historical document for Lutheranism. I mean, this is in many ways the first Lutheran confession that, in a sense, requires physical subscription to it by the major theologians of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get that again after this until the Formula of Concord, which is 40 years later.
Yeah.
I mean, almost exactly 40 years later.
So, thank you for that. Sorry. As we go forward, so the next one, 1541, I think the most interesting, and Adam, you talked about some documents, but most interesting thing to me happening outside of Lutheranism is that Calvin... Geneva is now Calvin's
the city
Geneva.
Of God.
Yeah.
Okay,
so the Reformed sort of have a location now in Geneva. The Lutherans have had Wittenberg. What's the difference between these two locales?
Oh gosh.
I would love to kind of explore why.
You mean what life was like in the two cities?
Mm-hmm.
There's a real contrast. Though the leaders of Geneva, the magistrates, didn't invent what was the laws in Geneva, they inherited them and blessed them. I mean, can you imagine in Wittenberg where you could be jailed for blasphemy? Wouldn't fit.
Yeah.
But in Geneva, though Dr. Horton tells me again and again, Geneva was not really a theocracy. You had practices that were top-down and required, and there was threat of civil punishment for breaking them.
Is he saying it wasn't a theocracy because within a theocracy you sort of have to acknowledge that you're getting a direct word from God on how to rule day to day and not just from a revealed Bible?
I think so. But you'd have to ask Dr. Horton. I mean, he's forgotten more about this than you and I will ever know.
That's probably true of most things.
You know? By the way, it's for our listeners, his two-volume recent work on justification, that's worth thinking about, maybe even taking a look at.
We should have him on the show to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I can send out an email.
You might want to send it via Rod.
Yeah. He might not recognize my name. It's just going to go straight to the spam box. I think it's interesting. Every once in a while online, you'll see like a funny quote out of a history book of something that happened like as a civil punishment in Calvin's Geneva.
Right.
Like I saw one the other day that was funny. It was like, man brought before the city council with his pants down because his wife said he was thinking about another woman while in bed with her. Like, and those kind of things where it was
Holy
documented
smokes.
As something that happened there.
Oh.
Now, I think some of these might be legend and some of them are more true, but I think it gets to the point where there was definitely more a focus on more moral reform in the city.
Absolutely. And the great historians have told us that over and over and over again. And they're correct. There's a legal element in classical Calvinism that's sort of absent in us. Luther started law school and dropped out. Calvin finished.
That's funny.
Interesting.
In the Servetus affair.
I like that.
In the Servetus affair, Calvin was recruited to be lawyer in the Servetus affair because he was really good at law, not because he wanted to see somebody hanged for denying the Trinity.
Yeah, yeah. Should we talk about the Servetus affair? Because I'm assuming,
yeah,
is it a good assumption that people don't know what that?
Yes.
Michael Servetus, a physician, I believe, originally from Spain, who wrote a number of theological works, and the one that gets him in hot water is his attack on the Trinity.
It, yes,
advocates a Unitarianism.
Yes.
And for whatever reason, I don't know, years ago I read up on it, but he winds up in Geneva, and he refuses to leave. I think he's kind of an outlaw everywhere, and he goes to Geneva, and I think Calvin says, just go on, so we don't have to
To don't come here.
And he just, he's sort of stubborn.
Yep.
And eventually...
A stubborn man during the Reformation.
Well, a stubborn Unitarian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then I think it was 1553, he's finally executed after some time in jail. And am I right that not only did Calvin represent him legally, but would sit with him in his cell and encourage him, or effectively try to persuade him of the truth of the Trinity?
Yep.
And so,
yep.
So holding, I mean, blasphemy laws are everywhere, right? In late medieval,
I mean, it's what early, Luther, early you know,
yeah.
Is
but in some places, so for example, in Lutheran Germany, Northern Germany, it's illegal to be a public blasphemer. But if you're privately a heretic or whatever, there's no clamping down. In Geneva,
if somebody finds
in
out,
private,
yeah,
you're in deep trouble.
Yep, that's a real difference.
Yeah, yeah. And I think they even encouraged people to kind of spy on their neighbor, didn't they? Like look in the window and see, are they drinking too much or using foul language? Or,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, you'd be in deep trouble, Caleb.
You'd be in even deeper trouble.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. What are you talking about? I don't have any neighbors. I'm actually pretty lucky. So as much as it is, there's a difference in sort of the ethos of moral reform. Geneva is also the center of this theological reform.
Oh, yes.
And so it's not just sort of, hey, this city is sort of our example of moral cleanup or how it would look like if Christian citizens were living properly, right? It's also where he's going to edit and refine the institutes and people are going to be educated there like they are in Wittenberg.
Yes.
At university. So,
And the other thing to remember is that almost every single thing during Calvin's life in Geneva, almost every single thing that he requested of the magistrates, they turned down. He was almost an utter failure at appealing to the civic realm on much of anything. They just said no over and over and over and over again.
He needed a Melanchthon.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, a peacemaker, huh?
Yeah.
So, Adam, you were talking before the show about, during this time period, some very interesting interaction between Luther and the Quran.
Yeah, I don't know how much time we have. I'll try to keep it really short. But from the siege on Vienna in 1529, in Luther's response to that, a work called On War Against the Turk, which actually started before the actual siege, he mentions in there that he's been asked to write on the religion of the Turks for so long, and he said, I'm not going to do it until I can actually get a primary source.
Hey,
until I can get until I can get the text of the Quran. I'm only going to talk about the politics of this and what little I do know of Islam from quotations from the Quranic text. And then 1541, 1542, I don't know which year it was, but on Shrove Tuesday, otherwise known as Fat Tuesday or Mardi Gras, the day before Ash Wednesday, he receives a copy of a manuscript of a Latin translation of the Quran that had been translated 400 years prior in Spain and made its way up into northern Germany. And at that point, Luther decides that the stuff he's read on Islam by especially Dominican theologians from the past who have been very, very critical of Islam, Luther decides that actually they're also very accurate in their description of Islam. So he decides in 1542 he's going to translate into German what is for 500 years, the most influential text a Christian ever wrote on how to address Islam polemically and apologetically. He translates it out of Latin into German, removes a lot of the scholastic stuff, adds in his own kind of coarse language, typical Luther, lots of foul language, and then instructs the publisher, Hans Luft, to publish it in a small format so that people who are on the front lines between Christian Europe and the Islamic Ottoman Empire could keep it in their pocket or their knapsack in case they get stuck behind enemy lines in Islamic territory, so that they might be equipped to address or respond to the challenge of Islam. That's 1542. The work is entitled A Refutation of the Quran. It has been translated into English. I think under a small little publishing house out of New Haven, Missouri, called Lutheran News, I believe. The translation's accurate, but it's not. The translator did no service in trying to make it understandable for 21st century readers. Unfortunately,
that's so common.
Yeah. Then the following year, though, Luther, there's a controversy that was brewing over in the city of Basel, and that was in the 1540s, probably the 1530s, and maybe even the 1520s, probably the most liberal city in all of Europe in terms of it being open to anything.
Okay.
Not just anything, but anything mm-hmm. with respect to the humanist movement and
maybe
Protestants
should have run away to there.
Yeah, no kidding. But there was a publisher there named Johannes Aparinus who had gotten a manuscript copy of this Quran, but a revised manuscript by one of the successors to Zwingli, a man named Theodor Bibliander. And he started printing it, and the city council learned of it, and they quickly arrested him and had him put in jail for trying to publish a heretical book, which is sort of odd for Basel, but maybe it's because of the conflict between the Turks and Christendom. Anyway, he's in jail. He appeals. It's kind of the record is hard. It's hard to discern who sends letters to people like Calvin and Luther and Melanchthon and all the who in the zoo
lot,
of Protestants, and a number of them respond. Martin Bucer responds. Melanchthon responds. Calvin doesn't. And the city council, they all appeal. Release this man so he can print this book. And they don't do anything until they get a letter from the old man in Wittenberg, Luther. And Luther argues in this little letter to the council, release this guy so people can finally have a primary text on the religion of the Turks. Moreover, you might as well do it because if he doesn't do it, we're going to do it in Wittenberg anyway. So release him and maybe you'll even make some money on it. And he goes in the letter, he says, we need this text right now so that Christians who are in the central or the eastern side of the central Europe could be equipped to become, as he puts it, lion hearts in the defense of the faith if they face the religion of the Turks. And shortly thereafter, I think it's just a matter of days, Aparinus is released with the instruction, you can go ahead and print the Quran, but just don't put the city from which it was printed in the front matter. So shortly thereafter, 1543, the Quran is printed, but not just the Quran. Some historians have called what came out of that printing press the first encyclopedia of the Quran, because it's a Quran, it's a bunch of literature, primary literature on Muhammad, written by Muslims originally. A section that includes histories of the Turks and lives of Muhammad, and then a section that includes all sorts of apologetic material written by medieval Christians on Islam. It's a huge book. Here's the interesting thing. 6 editions of it are published in 1543. It becomes, if you will, kind of a bestseller, at least for academic literature. And one of those editions, all of them had a Lutheran preface to it. Melanchthon wrote the preface for 5 of those editions, but probably the first edition that came out was one written by none other than Martin Luther, a preface on the Quran written by Martin Luther, which is mind-boggling, interesting. And in that preface, unlike Melanchthon, who warns readers warns readers that they're going to read something heretical, so be a little cautious. Luther's preface actually is an admonition. Read this and read this now because the situation is dire. We talked, I think, an episode or two ago about how Luther is starting to see the world in apocalyptic terms, and he really believes in 1543, because the Ottoman fleet had wintered in French ports and had a sort of an alliance with the French king, Francis, he believes that this was a sign that it was all going to come
crashing down
very soon. So he's especially, I argued in my dissertation years ago, man, more than 10 years ago now, that Luther's work on the Turks, while, yeah, it's political, it's pastoral, it's also, what many have missed is that it's also very, he's very much interested in Christians being able to defend the faith in a Muslim context. So that's 1543. Simultaneously, we probably, I don't know if we have time for this, but there's a lot of stuff that Luther writes in 1543 addressing issues related to Judaism, which is extremely controversial.
Yeah, Uwe's book is...
Fabricated Luther is a really good take on that, how to understand Luther in context so he's not lifted out and used by various parties to support...
Yeah, every once in a while you still see stuff. I saw something, it was a couple weeks ago, basically saying that modern Christians, don't dislike Jewish theology because the way Luther interpreted the New Testament and Jesus' treatment of Jewish leaders that it was, but that's all Luther's fault.
I think very interesting. 99.9% of Christians are not aware of anything Luther wrote.
I know.
Not anymore. I mean, certainly in the 20th century when the, it's unfortunate, and this is why Uwe Siemenetto's book, Fabricated Luther, is so important. The National Socialists in Germany in the 1930s took Luther's work called On the Jews and Their Lies and put it in a glass case. I think it was in Nuremberg as an example of how the German people have always been rallied against Judaism. Luther was, with Islam, he can say things where he'll say, our issue is not the Turkish people. Our issue is their religion. And it's the same with the Jewish people. It's not that they're ethnically, he didn't use that term, but ethnically Jewish. That's not a big deal. Our issue with Judaism is the way it maligns Jesus. More importantly, it's rejection of what is clear.
Yeah.
Jesus was the fulfillment of messianic prophecies.
Even from the New Testament, a person just with their familiarity with the New Testament can rightly come to the conclusion, it's really weird that I'm defending the Jewish Messiah to Jews or anybody else, and I'm Gentile. How weird is that? I'm a nobody. I'm going.
And you're pointing to Jewish messianic prophecy. As a Gentile.
Saying that it actually was fulfilled in Jesus, a Jewish man that they should have recognized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's Luther's whole point in his writings against the Jews in the 1520s.
He expected them to convert.
He did, and they did
by
not.
The thousands.
So, yeah, and so when in 1543 when he writes three works on Judaism that are, the rhetoric is pretty, it is very strong. It's perhaps regrettable. At the same time, it's very common on the part of Christian authors writing on Judaism and Jewish authors writing on Christianity at the time.
That would be the question is, do we have any sort of like response, from Jews who would have read it during the time period or anything?
We do. Not necessarily that, but we do. There's a scholar out of the University of Jerusalem, I think that's where he is anyway, Asaf Ben Tov, I think is his name.
Yeah.
Who has written, he wrote an article, maybe it's become a book, this is going back 15 years, where he argues that Luther's response to Judaism is, you could totally anticipate it, because if you look at the Jewish literature, blaspheming Christ purposely, even the Jewish liturgies would put in anti-Christian polemical assertions, and so that Luther would respond to that is shouldn't surprise us. And this is a Jewish man arguing that point.
Yeah, Ben Tov is actually he's done a lot of work on Lutheran humanism and Melanchthon as well.
Yeah, he's sort of a wunderkind. In his 20s, he had I don't know how many books he had out already. He's just an incredible scholar.
Well, I think the last things I want to wrap this episode up are just kind of seeing some of the broader what's going on in the world is that as we're looking at sort of this one town in Wittenberg, it's hard, we can forget that this is sort of an era of exploration too. Like the West is expanding. Japan's just been explored by the first Western traders to make it that direction. North America has been...
DeSoto makes it to the Mississippi River in the early 1540s.
So. Copernicus's theory about the centrality of the sun is published during the same period of time. So this is sort of like, politically too, Western expansion is happening and is about to ramp up.
Yeah, historians used to call this the Age of Discovery. You know, the big, so you got Reformation and Renaissance, but those are just pieces of this broader period of the Age of Discovery in terms of science and geography, and the world is getting huge, if you will, and also flat at this time. There's a book, I think it's Heinrich Bornkamm, on the history of the Reformation. I forget the exact title, where he makes mention that, I believe it was at Worms, it may have been at Augsburg, that Charles V actually parades out Native Americans as just sort of tokens of the reach of his power. So the world is getting, the world is not just Germany, obviously. It's
well, and we've talked about the political implications of Protestant theology too. With all this travel and trade going on, if a whole nation becomes Protestant, that could have huge political implications on the empire. Who's then going to have another enemy, you know, out there, just the Turk. I think, you know, we've said it a lot in this series, trying to focus back on that, but I think it's one of those things that you can forget just looking at as you read doctrine coming up from here. It's really easy to forget that a lot of these decisions, which we go, that doesn't make any sense doctrinally or biblically, why would they do that, are politically motivated. Okay, well, I think that basically closes out this episode. Like I said, we're getting close to the end of Luther's life, which is going to see sort of a transition in the way Lutheranism reacts to various issues. And Dr. Keith here has actually done a lot of, you talk about this a lot. So
the interims and whatnot, yeah.
So we're going to be heading on to 1545 next episode. Thank you for listening to this episode. Again, you can find all of the podcasts at 1517 and anything else that we do at 1517.org. Podcasts are /podcasts. Thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.